Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I have invited on the program Renato Nicolai, author of The Nightmare That Is Public Education, an expose of what really happens in public schools. Born in San Francisco, Dr. Nicolai graduated with a BA in English and an MA in education from the University of San Francisco. He also earned a Doctor of Education degree from the University of Southern California. During a career spanning nearly 40 years, Dr. Nick, which he likes to be called, taught English, literature, and social studies in grades 7 through 11 in public schools in Northern California. He was the principal of two elementary schools and one middle school, and substituted in grades 6 through 12 in retirement. He's written curriculum materials for the Santa Clara County Office of Education on how to teach standards and has been a presenter at various conferences, in-service sessions, and conventions, speaking about teaching methods, literature-based instruction, standards and expectations, discipline, and classroom management. Dr. Nick lives in Roseville, California with his wife, Betty Ann. They will be celebrating their 46th wedding anniversary in August of 2008. They have 5 sons and 5 grandchildren. So welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Dr. Nick.
Thank you very much, Juanita. I'm very pleased to be here today, and I'm looking forward to telling you as much as I can about my book.
Well, great, great. There are so many issues to cover on this subject. I'm just so happy to actually have you on the phone and have this opportunity. So first off, a congratulations is in order. This was, I'm sure, quite a book to write.
Yes, it was. It's based on my nearly 40 years of experience in basically California public schools, mm-hmm. although, you know, the information that it contains applies to schools all over the nation as well. And so I put my heart and soul into it for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, how long have you actually been away from the educational system, and when did the idea for writing this book actually take effect for you?
I'm in my 6th year of retirement from public schools. The idea to write the book, well, I would say generated probably about 5 years before I retired. I have an interesting habit, maybe some people would call it a skill. I like to think things through very thoroughly, and so the genesis of the book started to go through my mind about 5 years before I retired, and shortly after I retired, I decided to start putting my thoughts down in writing, and it took about 8 or 9 months to write the book, and then, as you know, the publishing process is such that it takes longer to actually get it in print.
Sure, sure. So who did you write this book for, and what was your initial intention and hope for readers?
I wrote the book for parents, teachers, and young people in grades 7 through 12. I would include 5th and 6th grade as well. The intention was to try to motivate teachers to teach better so that students will learn to their maximum capacity. My feeling is that many students, especially at the middle school and high school levels, are not learning as much as they possibly can and are not really reaching their potential in terms of what they can learn. And so I hoped through this book to present ideas, methods, strategies, plans, and other kinds of things for teachers to use to bring about that enhanced learning in students. I also decided to help parents do that for themselves and along with the teachers who teach their children. So there are many, many ideas and for instance, a set of questions, things that parents can do to assist their children and also to assist the teacher.
Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people that aren't well-versed with this issue kind of believe, I mean, this is what we mostly hear, is that there's a problem with the system due to the standardized testing. But what you're saying is it runs much deeper than that.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Would you like me to go into that a little bit?
Why don't you? You know, there are some main reasons that I know that you think that this public education system is a nightmare, and this is the title of your book. So, yeah, you do talk a lot about the teacher specifically, but I know that you have a lot of reasons. So let's get into it.
I don't believe there's any one major problem in public schools, which is the cause for some of the situations we hear about in the news. Low test scores, violence. People know what they are as well as I do. I don't need to list them all. Mm-hmm. I think there is a whole gamut of problems, and I basically believe the public school system is broken. Mm-hmm. It needs to be fixed. It needs a total shot in the arm, so to speak, in order to bring things about. So what do I think are some of these problems specifically? Well, first of all, some teachers are simply not meant to teach. They are mediocre and perhaps at the worst incompetent. If you've been in as many classrooms as I have over a career of nearly 40 years, I mean it's hundreds and hundreds of teachers and hundreds of classrooms, the quality of the teaching, especially at that middle school, junior high school, and high school level, is just not what it should be. We should expect our teachers to be much more professional and perform much better. So that's one of the problems. Another problem is that so many teachers just don't exhibit enough enthusiasm to get the material across. You hear students say quite often that one of the major problems that they encounter is that teachers are boring. Well, I mean, if you're a 7th grader or a 9th grader or an 11th grader or in one of the other grades in middle school or high school, and you have to sit in that classroom with that particular teacher who has a monotone and doesn't show any life at all when it comes to teaching the subject, you'd say that that teacher was boring too.
Right.
And so the kids really are on target. Mm-hmm. Most teachers are boring. They don't put together their lessons in such a way as to enliven and enthuse the excitement of learning in children. Now, I'm not saying it's easy to do that. None of this is easy.
Mm-hmm.
But we need people who are committed to doing it,
yes,
who in their hearts want children to learn better. And so they will then do these things and correct these wrongs. A third one is the management and control of student behavior is such that, well, I get tongue-tied here because there's such a chasm of not knowing what to do. There's such a void of not knowing what to do. Teachers need to be taught specifically how to manage and control student behavior. More than ever before, we need teachers who are competent in that area, and we just don't have enough of them. Another problem is that teachers really need to be taught how to manage their classrooms better. The classroom itself can be an extremely effective learning tool. I'm talking about bulletin boards and learning stations and all kinds of decorations and so on. You know, Juanita, the next time you go into a high school or a middle school or the next time you speak to people who do, ask them to take a look at a high school classroom. Generally speaking, it's a horrible place in which to learn.
Yes.
It doesn't have any color to it. It doesn't have any excitement to it. Now compare that to a third grade classroom.
That's really true. Mm-hmm.
You know, third mm-hmm. grade classrooms are filled with stimuli to help children learn. So the argument that's given to me constantly is, oh, well, it's not age appropriate for, you know, 11th graders or whatever.
Right.
That's a bunch of baloney.
Mm-hmm.
Children are children. They want to learn. They need to learn. You can help them learn if you're a teacher by stimulating them with an exciting classroom environment, an environment which itself is a learning tool. I'll tell you, when you walked into my classroom, I you know, taught all of those grades. Primarily, I taught the 8th grade. You walked into my classroom, and there were many, many different displays, bulletin boards, and other kinds of things. And I didn't leave it that way for the entire year. I changed it.
Changed it, yeah.
I got my parents in there, you know, on a Saturday or whatever, And we changed it to fit the unit or to fit the season of the year, whatever it happened to be.
What did you see with the children when they would come in and see those changes in that stimulus?
Well, you could see it in their faces.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah, I bet.
I mean, if you didn't see it, they wouldn't be children. I mean, even adults did the same thing. They'd walk in and they'd see it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the mouths would drop a little bit and the eyes would go a little bit wide. And those are the kinds of things that tell you right away, well, you know, they noticed it.
You sparkled.
For instance, how many times has a parent gone into a classroom and seen a bulletin board which has student work on the bulletin board, but a comment next to a paper or next to a diagram or whatever it happens to be that says, if you want to really learn how to write an outline, see Mary or see Juan or whatever it happens to be. In other words, the bulletin board can be used to teach, and that's a very simple example of what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Another deficiency and another problem is that teachers, generally speaking, do not effectively control group learning. Now, the education ease is facilitate groups. Teachers will tell you that they use groups, but children at all levels will do everything in their power to, you know, chat with each other and, you know, get to, well, what's going on at lunch or whatever it is. So the teacher has to have the skill necessary to manage and control the groups. Now, the reason this is so important is because teachers know that children, young people, can help other young people learn very effectively, sometimes even better than the teacher, him or herself, can. The student has the right words, has the savvy, has the ability to bring out the aha, you know?
Yeah.
So we need to use that. We need to tap into it. Well, if you can't control and manage groups, if you can't facilitate the students and control their behavior when they're in groups, then all of that time is wasted, mm-hmm. whereas it could be used effectively to help teach. Mm-hmm. Another one is that teachers don't have high enough academic expectations and standards.
Okay.
There was a book written many years ago, I believe in the, in the 70s somewhere, entitled Pygmalion in the Classroom. One of the authors was Dr. Lenore Jacobson. I had the pleasure of knowing Lenore. And she wrote it in conjunction with, I think it was Dr. Rosenthal. He was a Harvard professor. In any case, he was a Harvard professor, helped her. And the whole idea was that it was the old Pygmalion concept. If you expect a student to reach a certain area and you are sincere about it and you do everything in your power to make the student believe it, generally speaking, the student will rise to that expectation.
Right.
Well, our expectations are too low.
Yeah, that's true.
We need to shoot for the moon. Mm. We've already been to the moon. Maybe we ought to shoot for Mars.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to insist that our students can do superior work. They want to, for the most part. If we show them that we expect them to do so, then I think that they will. Mm. The other area that has to do with this is that teachers don't have high enough behavioral expectations and standards as well. Mm. Now, behavior is a whole issue in itself, and it's a very complicated one. But our teachers have to be proficient at managing behavior, and the expectations should be that the student is going to cooperate,
mm-hmm.
and the standards should be high so that the student understands that this is what's expected.
Now, for teacher training, Dr. Nick, are these areas not really talked about when teachers are going through their education to become teachers, like the classroom control and the student discipline and the expectation of high standards, whether it be academic or behavioral? Are these things not addressed to new teachers?
You know, Juanita, I'm sure they are. It's been a long time since I've been a classroom to take an education course,
mm-hmm.
but I'm sure they are. I can't speak knowledgeably about the effectiveness of what's being covered in that curriculum. All I know is that when I have gone in the past to observe teachers, new teachers in particular, many of these areas are pretty much foreign to them. So whatever is happening, it's either not sticking or it's not being presented in a context that makes sense to them. I really don't know. All I know is that I go one step beyond your question and say that we probably shouldn't have education professors teaching the courses. We probably should have people like me teaching them.
That's true. That's a great point.
Or others like me. I mean, there are lots of people out there who have these same ideas that I have.
Mm-hmm.
I just wrote them down in a book.
Right.
So the seasoned, professional, competent teacher, and don't get me wrong, there are many of them out there for sure. If we were to get those people to teach our young people who are coming in, and then assist them in the classroom, I think it would make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, that's how I would answer that.
When did you begin to see things declining? I mean, you've had a very long career in this field. When was the decline visibly noticeable for you?
You know, I've been asked a question similar to that in the past, and I would answer, I started my career in 1963. And throughout the 60s and 70s, even throughout the 80s, I didn't notice the kinds of things that I think were bringing the school system down the way it is now. I would say with a new generation of teachers that came in maybe in the late 80s and into the 90s that I noticed things a little bit more. I retired in 2001, so I would say that it was approximately around that time. But I want to make another point. The decline in education from the point of view of reform has been going on for the past 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's 60. And if you go back and take a look at all of the books that have been written, the curriculum changes that have been made, you know, you've heard of the new math and all of that. Of course, that's way, way back there now.
Mm-hmm.
Things that have been written like a nation at risk, and then after that, a nation still at risk, and the various reforms taking place in the state level throughout the United States, right up to No Child Left Behind. None of these reforms have really made a significant difference.
Mm.
You haven't seen a tremendous increase in competency or literacy or learning on the part of students as a result of any of these things. And there's a reason for it. They're never going to make a significant difference, none of these things, even if they come in the future, because it has to start with the person in the classroom. The philosophy I have is that the most important person in the learning process, other than the learner, the student, is the person doing the teaching. And that person, that teacher, is the one that has to make the commitment to improve, to become as proficient as possible, and to make a difference in the life of the student.
Mm.
It's a tough job.
Yeah.
It's not an easy job, but we need people who are committed with their heart, not only their brain. So hopefully that answers the question for you.
Yeah, well, why do you think that individuals go into the teaching profession without that high standard or without that motivation and, you know, just kind of express that mediocrity or, you know, that, I don't know, I just don't understand why an incompetent teacher would want to teach children, you know?
Well, one answer to that is that the person who's in that position won't view themselves as incompetent.
I guess not.
Yeah, they don't see themselves as incompetent. Many of the things that I've just said to you will stand the hair on the heads of people out there who are in education because they don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they don't see it is, and here's another problem, okay? The evaluation of teachers in the public school system is disgraceful. I mean, teachers can't do any wrong. It's called collegiality. It's a euphemism for, you know, I'm a professional, I have a college degree, and I really know what I'm doing, so leave me alone and let me do it. And so that's what the administration does. It leaves teachers alone, and they do their own thing. And it's really, what they do is not really monitored to the degree that it helps that person improve. Even if you say, I think you should improve, in many cases, the union in supporting the teacher will say, well, how dare you say that this person needs to improve?
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
It's just not one thing. It's this whole idea that goes all the way through that, oh, everything's fine. I'm professional, and I'm collegial, and I can do pretty much what I want.
Mm. Now, when you were in a position of teaching, did you consider yourself a superb teacher? And what did you do to develop your teaching skills and not fall into that category of mediocrity?
Well, let me start off by saying, yes, I did consider myself to be a superb teacher. When you have enough parents tell you that,
you know.
Then you know. And
yeah.
When you have kids come back after middle school from high school and tell you that and write you letters, then you know that you're doing something that is a little different maybe compared to some others. The parents would petition to have children in my classroom. So that's another indication. But then your question says, you know, what did I do personally?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that teachers need to do, I think, I have in my book, I think it's in the first chapter, 8 essential qualities of an excellent teacher. And one of them is that the teacher evaluates him or herself. So that's what I did. I evaluated myself constantly. Now, how do you do that? Well, you know, you have to step back from yourself sometimes to do that. So on occasion, I would ask the kids to do it.
Mm.
And it could be just a discussion, or it could be done anonymously in a written form. And then other times, I would take a look and see what the performance of my students was on a particular concept or idea or test. And I'd ask myself, well, you know, I'm not happy with that. I'm not happy with the results. I think more of them could understand it better. So then I'd go back and take a look at what I did and try to figure out what I could do differently to maybe make a difference. Or I'd ask the kids to tell me, you know, what can I do to help you understand this better? And they'll tell you. They'll do that for sure. It also has to do with my personality, Juanita. I'm not satisfied unless I can perform to the best of my ability as often as I possibly can. Mm. You know, when I went into education, I didn't look upon education as a job,
mm-hmm,
or an activity that resulted in a paycheck at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
I did it because I wanted to teach children to their potential. It's as simple as that. So I knew I wasn't going to make a whole lot of money. I wasn't interested in making a whole lot of money, Juanita.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I really wasn't.
Really?
I wanted to serve. And that's the kind of people we need out there.
Absolutely.
We need people who know what they're doing, have accepted it, and will do whatever is necessary to get it across. I just wish that the ones that are out there that are excellent and proficient were respected and acknowledged more than they are.
Oh.
Because we do have a lot of them. But for the most part, they're, let's call them a silent minority.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Amazon recently introduced Kindle, a revolutionary ebook reader that has outpaced expectations in sales. This is a sign that more people are turning to the digital delivery system of books as the practice of digital downloads spread. Let us help you get your printed book or ebook available for instant purchase on Amazon Kindle. You set your own price and collect 35% of list price on each sale. We will upload your book and optimize it for the best performance on Kindle. Please go to readerviews.com and link on the Services for Authors tab on the top menu bar. There you will find a link for more information on how we can upload your book for Kindle viewing today. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm speaking with Renato Nicolai, a.k.a. Dr. Nick. And you can find out more about Dr. Nick and his book, The Nightmare That Is Public Education, through his website, www.drnickweb.com. So how could we get more of those kinds of teachers in the system?
Oh, my goodness.
yeah.
Well, we need to change the public school system and turn it upside down.
Yeah.
So people who are thinking the way I just explained and described will consider going into education. You know, I read somewhere, I can't remember specifically now where it is, but I read somewhere recently that many young people who are intelligent, savvy, you know, good students, can go through a four-year college degree and are just looking to go out there and save the world, so to speak, don't even consider teaching. And the reason they don't, I suppose, in part is because of what many people believe is low pay, and to a certain degree they're correct, although not totally, and that's another subject. But I think also it's because they don't get the kind of recognition and praise that the business community can provide. So I guess we need incentives to have them come in. I don't know, bonuses for signing up or other kinds of incentives. I can't think of them off the top of my head right now.
Sure.
School districts could go into colleges and make presentations. Young people could be invited to come into classrooms and see what really excellent teachers do. Those kinds of things perhaps would help.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be the right type of person.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
That's key. Yes.
I just wonder if some of those people that would be so great in teaching positions are maybe somewhat disillusioned with the system at this point, because a lot of people understand that it is broken and it does need some deep, deep changes.
Yes, I think you're correct. Mm-hmm. I think there is a disillusionment there, and that's a big factor in making up their minds as to whether or not they should choose it.
Yeah,
I think that's... that's a very important point.
Mm-hmm. So for teachers, you know, let's get back to your book and what teachers reading it can find out about ideas and solutions you have for some of the issues that they face. What are the key areas that you're actually addressing?
Sure, happy to talk about that. You know, the book has a negative title. The reason for that was to call it to everybody's attention so that they would see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's filled. Believe me, every chapter has innovative ideas and suggestions and lists.
Yes, and I love that about this book, because it's not just a complaining diatribe. No, you offer solutions, and it's fantastic.
The first chapter has the 8 essential qualities that most teachers don't possess. I go into detail as to what they are. I'll just give you one example of one so that they'll understand what I mean.
Sure.
Teachers, most teachers, I'm not going to say some, most teachers, do not have acting skills, and acting skills are essential. Now, I don't mean that you're a phony and that you pretend to be a character. That's not what I mean at all.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is probably what you've noticed in this interview, my voice.
Mm-hmm.
People who teach have to be taught how to use their voice. Voice is an extremely important part of teaching. You use it all the time, and most teachers don't know how to use their voice. They usually speak in a monotone. They don't know how to excite. They don't know when to whisper, when to be louder, when whatever. Now, I eliminate most elementary teachers. They do know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's just one of them. So, and I have, there are 7 other qualities that I think are important to teaching that most teachers just don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that chapter does. The second chapter goes into how to prepare the classroom physical environment as a learning tool, and it gives lists of what to do to bring that about exactly, so that will help learning. The third chapter talks about the academic and behavioral expectations and standards, and in that chapter there is a list of how to teach standards. You know, many teachers, when the standards movement first came on the scene, were appalled at it and were against it. This list of 10 things on how to teach standards will assist teachers immensely. The very first one is to meticulously plan a lesson. Many teachers don't even plan their lessons anymore, Juanita.
I know. I've actually heard that. That's
they
scary.
They just walk into the classroom and they just, you know, what's the expression I'm trying to think of?
Just off the cuff?
Yeah, off the cuff or seat of the pants, however
yeah.
you want. No. They have to be prepared. That doesn't mean you have to spend 2 hours preparing each lesson, but they have to be planned. Mm-hmm. And so it goes into the other nine on how to teach standards. The next chapter goes into the how instruction is wasted through the waste of time, how learning is wasted. Talking over noise at the change of activities, noise at the end of the classroom. If you were to add up all of this, as I have in this chapter, you'll see that most teachers are losing 20 to 25% of every teaching session, just wasting it.
That's incredible. 25?
Gone.
Are you serious?
And back in the 70s, Madeline Hunter did some, I believe she did some testing on this or some research on this, and I think she came up with even a larger percentage.
Mm.
I don't remember all the details about that. But I know in my own research, the number I came up with at a minimum is right around 22% is simply wasted. So I've indicated to parents how they can observe this so they can point it out to their teachers. Parents need to be much more actively involved,
yes,
and speak to what they see and observe. But they don't know what to observe. They don't know what to see. They need to be taught how to look at the teaching process, and that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
There's another chapter in there that goes into the many areas of schools having to do with its culture, and I talk about reticence, permissiveness, mediocrity, and progressiveness. And each one of those is an area which is helping to bring our schools down. So the person who is listening has to read the book to find out about those specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things that are in the book. I haven't, going through all of them. Our time is limited, but hopefully people will be interested enough to pick up a copy.
Absolutely. So what about for students? Do you talk about what students can do? Children these days are very smart. I mean, children have always been smart, but they are so intuitive, these kids coming up now. And I would imagine that they see that these teachers could care less. So what can they do to begin creating a positive change in the system or in their classroom or in their school? What can they do?
Now, depending upon the age level of the student, the answer would be a little different.
Sure.
If we're talking about the high school level, then the maturity level is such, generally speaking, that these children could, they're still children, by the way. All right?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
We have to understand that.
Yeah.
16-year-olds are still children.
Oh, yes.
As far as I'm concerned, they're children. So some of them are mature enough to be able to make a difference. So what can they do? Well, certainly they can start by complaining to their parents about whatever the problem is. My teacher is boring, or my teacher goes off on a tangent and doesn't talk about the subject area, or my teacher is expressing personal opinions and trying to force us to understand them, and my teacher said this, and is it true or not, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So then the parent and the student together perhaps could approach the administration of the school. If that doesn't work, you can go as far as the superintendent or the board of trustees or board of education, whatever it's called. That's certainly a way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Students can put out petitions. I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
They see something that's not in the best interest of their learning, and they want to make a difference and change it so that they can learn better. That's their motivation. God bless them. I'm all for it. Write up the petition, have it signed by as many students who are inclined to sign it, and then present it to, I suppose, the person who is the one that you would start with would be the teacher. And if that doesn't seem to work any, then you go beyond the teacher to the principal and keep going. Sometimes a group of students can just meet with a teacher. Three or four students could just talk informally. Gee, these are some of our thinkings. This is some of our thinking. These are some of our feelings. What do you think? And just hash it out. Now, the teachers are going to react differently. So depending upon the reaction of the teacher will depend upon what the student can do next. The problem with all of this is that most high school students don't want to be singled out. They don't want to be different in the sense of being having attention called to them. Mm-hmm. They want to blend in. They want to cooperate with their peer group. They want to be part of the group. So it takes a very, very strong-willed, mature person to even start these kinds of things. But my goodness, more power to them.
Yeah,
if they take over their own responsibility and their have their own best interest in mind in terms of learning. On the middle school level, it's much more difficult. It has to be from the parents.
Parents,
the maturity level is just not there.
Not there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some 8th graders who are more mature than 11th graders, but not that many that would make a difference.
A big difference,
right. So I think the parents would have to be involved there. Mm-hmm. You know, 8th graders talking about 13 or 14-year-olds. So that would be hard.
Yes.
On the elementary level, of course, it can't happen.
It wouldn't happen, no, not at all. So what do you think, if nothing is done about these inadequacies of the educational system, what do you foresee as being the future effect on society as a whole?
Well, what's happening more and more, but it's not being reported, so the public doesn't really know about it, is that more and more students and parents are leaving the public school systems.
Mm-hmm.
They're going into private schools. They're going into other types of learning situations. And so eventually, if this continues to happen, and if more and more parents decide to send their children to alternative type schools, then the public school system is going to start feeling it from a financial point of view. In other words, many school districts throughout the nation are based on something called average daily attendance, and they get their funding as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have enough students coming in to get the kind of funds you want, then, you know, I suppose they start laying off teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't foresee that happening in the near future. In a rampant way, although I know it has happened. So that's one possibility. More and more competent teachers and those who are really superior are getting out of the system. They'll only stay maybe 2 or 3 years, and then they see that this isn't for them and they realize what's happening, so they leave. So then what happens is you get replacements that aren't on the level of their proficiency, and so things become worse as it goes on. I really don't have much hope for it. I encourage competition.
That's a good point. So there, I mean, alternative schools are popping up everywhere. Homeschooling, I believe, is at like an unprecedented all-time high. It's really incredible what's happening with the shift.
Yes, it is. So, you know, I encourage people to look at charter schools and magnet schools and homeschooling and parochial schools or religious schools, companies that provide schooling and training like Sylvan and Huntington and those kinds. I suppose it's even possible. I have a chapter at the end of the book that talks about maybe even a parallel school system, although I think that's just a what if. It's not anything that I think is ever going to happen. But suppose we had a second school system that was based on principles and values that are different from what we have now, and that particular system was in competition with the current one.
Right.
You know, I'll give you an insight here. On a 2020 program, I think that's an ABC affiliate, 2020, John Stossel, I think it was called Stupid in America.
I remember that.
Yeah, that was back in 2005 or so or four, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
I referenced it in my book.
Mm-hmm.
He interviewed a teacher. I don't remember where the teacher was from, but I quoted her in my book. And the teacher said something like, competition isn't any good for schools. It never has been any good for schools. Children don't learn because of competition, and we should never have it. And in the book, the next paragraph I start with, hard to believe, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But you see, we've got people out there with that mentality, and they're in the classroom, and they're teaching our children.
Mm-hmm. Impressionable, open children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyhow, competition, I think, is one of the keys to making a difference, at least maybe poking the public school system in the behind and giving it incentive to look at itself and say, gee, maybe we ought to do some things differently here.
Mm-hmm. So possibly it would be a bottom line dollar issue that would have to be the motivating factor to change the public system.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I would say it usually is the motivation that makes a difference in a whole wide area of things in our country. So certainly it will make a difference in education as well.
Mm-hmm. So fascinating, Dr. Nick. How can we find out more information? What's your website address?
The website is www.drnickweb.com. DrNickWeb.com.
Great. And what all do you have up on your website? Do you have a blog and that sort of thing up there?
I don't have a blog. I'm working on that. But it does provide for email. So, you know, people can email me if they'd like.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have an interview that was done in a written form that's there. There are reviews. I have a synopsis of the book. I have a summary of its contents. There's a little information about my background. So another thing that I'm going to be putting in there are excerpts from the book. For instance, try to entice people to purchase the book by putting in maybe two or three of those eight qualities that teachers don't have.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be working on that in the near future as well.
Have you thought at all about taking this book kind of on the road and going into schools and talking with teachers at all, or is there anyone that's doing anything like that?
I've thought about it. I'm not so sure it would be appropriate for me to actually go into the schools.
Mm.
I'm thinking about conventions,
mm-hmm.
Different kinds of association meetings, you know, to be able to make a presentation. I haven't followed up on that completely yet, but that's another one of those things that's back there that I am thinking about doing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about PTAs. I've attempted to make a presentation with a couple of PTAs, but that hasn't worked. I think the title frightens some people.
Frightened.
That may be the reason why.
Well, the substance in your book is just so crucial, and it really needs to get out to as many teachers and parents as possible. So we definitely hope that that it does, and you're able to get out there and talk to people about it. How have responses been from people in the system so far? I mean, this book just came out very recently.
Yes, it did. There's a principal of a charter school in Oakland, California. His name is Dr. Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
And he contacted me, and he said that he was thinking about buying a copy of the book for every one of his teachers, mm-hmm. because of the very things that we've been talking about here, that it has so many different positive suggestions to help people. I've had another retired principal contact me and tell me that he thought every parent and teacher in the United States should read it. Boy, that would be wonderful.
Wouldn't it?
then I've had a couple of negative comments, too, as you might imagine.
Sure.
Because it's going to be threatening to to teachers.
Yep.
Teachers are going to look at the administration as being the problem, and they're going to look at outside of themselves. And what I'm saying is I'm trying to motivate them to look within themselves. You know, the teacher has this fantastic opportunity within the four walls of a classroom with, what, say 30 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that teacher is so pivotal to the learning that takes place with those children that to have that is almost an honor. Now, some of those kids can be a real pain, let me tell you.
Oh, yes.
And they can be extremely, you know, vociferous and contemptible, even. Some of them can be horrible. But the professional has to handle that. Mm. That's why the teacher is the professional.
Mm.
So we can't complain and hope that that's going to go away. The person who's in the classroom has to handle that and cope with it and bring it about to the benefit of as many children as possible to learn. But that opportunity to be with those kids is an absolutely fantastic one. That's where the change has to take place.
Yes, yes. And then it becomes an issue.
Blog Talk Radio.